The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, back inside the belly in the ReliefFactor.com studio. Good morning to you on this Thursday. After I was done broadcasting in Hillsdale yesterday, I made my way back to the Beltway, and the news hit that inflation had gone up 3.5% month over month. Core inflation, almost 4%. And it's a stunner. It's a stunner, and it's bad out there. As the Financial Times put it this morning, the political peril for the president is significant. They didn't point out that the peril to consumers is real, not significant, real. You're just paying too much for everything. The Financial Times continued, the consumer price index is up 18.9% since Biden took office in January 2021. 18.9%. It'll be 20% by the time we get to the election. I don't know how anyone gets reelected having cut your standard of living by 20%, which is what inflation does. Fed rate cuts are now a matter of if, not just when, says The Wall Street Journal. And I could go on and on, but I don't have to tell you anything about inflation. You live it. You live it every time you stop at the gas station. By the way, we're going to get worse. It's going to get worse as we go along. But I am, in the meantime, the more important story this morning. Israel is on alert. Iran has threatened to strike it from Iran. And the United States may help if not. Meanwhile, the IDF is conducting a targeted operation in Gaza's Nuseirat. That's in the Times of Israel this morning. And the Hamas leader who's in Qatar, Ismail Haniyeh, lost all three sons yesterday in a Israeli strike on the Gaza Strip as the hostage negotiations just freeze. Israel's working to free the hostages, writes the Washington Post, headlined by Shira Rubin, without knowing if they are alive or dead. And the New York Times adds, Hamas does not have 40 hostages who meet the terms of a potential swap with Israel, suggesting many of them. And John Podhoretz is very careful to point out, we don't know anything about this number. This was reported in Channel 12 in Israel and hasn't been picked up. But the reality of what's going on in the United States with Joe Biden's infirmity and his incoherence vis-a-vis Israel and the buy-in to Hamas propaganda and the collapse of the administration was the subject of a podcast by the Commentary Quartet that I listened to twice yesterday. It was John Podhoretz, Matt Contineni, Abe Greenwald, and Seth Mandel. And I'm not going to play you the full podcast. You should be following the Commentary Podcast. They're the best podcast. But for the best conversation on the incoherence of the Biden administration over 6 months, I mean, absolutely incoherent. You need to listen to, let's start where, it's about 22 minutes in yesterday when they turn to the subject of America's policy towards Israel. Let's pick it up right there.
Let's move to a more, a far darker and stranger thing that happened last night. Apparently last week, it's very weird. Last week, Biden gave an interview to Univision that was held back for a week. It took place like last Wednesday or last Thursday, and then they only released it yesterday. Don't quite understand what's going on there, because it's very newsworthy what he said, unless it was, you know, unless it was a deal and they embargoed it. I don't know. It's on their special show they wanted better ratings for. I don't understand it. Anyway, he says Israel should just set up a unilateral ceasefire for 6 to 8 weeks to let all aid and food and everything pass freely around Gaza. He said this last week while right before he came out and blasted Israel for what happened with the World Central Kitchen. And, you know, before the administration announced Israel had to change policy and where they were going to change our policy and all of that. So again, is he senile? Was he establishing new policy last week that was somehow kept from the American people, where the United States is now advocating a unilateral ceasefire on the part of Israel to allow Hamas 8 weeks to regroup while Hamas itself is not subject to the terms of ceasefire?
That was John Podhoretz saying it up. This is Matt Continetti at this point. Again, this is a 45-minute conversation, which I can't play for you, but I just want to tease you into downloading yesterday's commentary podcast, getting to minute 22, and listening to how deep the despair we have fallen into, the incoherence that engulfs our Israeli policy. Go back to Matt Continetti.
I think to understand what he's trying to say, you have to turn to Thomas L. Friedman of the New York Times, who basically puts on a bulletin board every couple weeks what the Biden administration policy is in the Mideast. And so I'll just read the next to last paragraph in Tom Friedman's column today. He writes, quote, President Biden has a plan. Get to a 6-week ceasefire and hostage release, after which, as part of the Saudi normalization package, the president will come out with a bold peace initiative, what Israeli peace process expert Gidi Grinstein has called more for more, more security and normalization with Arab states than Israel was ever offered, and more Arab and U.S. help for Palestinians to achieve statehood than they've ever experienced. Hopefully, such an initiative can induce everyone to make the ceasefire permanent and further marginalize Hamas and Iran. Close quote. Now, what's the most important word in that paragraph? Hopefully, because it rests on a total illusion that this would succeed because of the good intentions of the evil people who run Hamas and Iran. And it gets even better in the last paragraph of Friedman's column. He says, quote, I have read all the articles about how a two-state solution is now impossible. I think they are 95% correct. But I'm going to focus on the 5% chance that they are wrong and the chance that courageous leadership can make them wrong. Close quote.
So what you're saying is that Friedman is now adopting the dumb and dumber foreign policy,
yeah.
Right? The scene in Dumb and Dumber when Jim Carrey says to Lauren Holly, what chance do we have together? And she says, one in a billion. And he says, so there's a chance.
Yeah. So as you say,
focus on the 5%.
Right. It's the 1% doctrine in reverse.
Yeah.
Right. Wasn't that with Cheney's after 9/11? He says, if there's a 1%,
right.
Yeah. If there's a 1% chance that this,
the world is destroyed.
Right. This rogue state is going to acquire nuclear weapons and give them to Al Qaeda. We can't afford that, so we have to act in Iraq.
Yeah.
This is, there's a 5% chance that my cockamamie scheme to establish peace in the Middle East after decades and decades of irreconcilable conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis, well, we're going to just do that, and we're going to ignore the realities on the ground, which says this deal would not fly at all.
This is Seth Mandel talking. Okay, pick it back up now. That was Seth.
Whole time with communications that they clarified. We should note, by the way, that this is in line with and walked back either this statement or the broad interpretations of his what he said in the interview. He said that he was referring to the truce being negotiated by his administration that would see some 40 hostages released over a period of 6 to 8 weeks, quote, and this is what they talked to the Times of Israel, because the Times of Israel called them out on it. There is no change in our position. President was reiterating our longstanding position, We are calling for an immediate ceasefire that would last for at least 6 weeks as part of a hostage deal. And then the person who responded to the Times of Israel said his quote makes that clear. So, okay, you know, whatever we're all misinterpreting, the president was very clear. And now that we've been informed that the president is clear after about, 12 or 14 hours of this discussion, I suppose we can readjust our priors or something like that. But this is very typical of, Biden. This was, 7 days ago he said this, and it's released yesterday, and then it causes a thing, and then he says that's not what I meant. And so, we're 7 or 8 days.
I'm going to come back and play just a little bit more of this. Because they spend a half an hour, Podhoretz, Mandel, Continetti, A. Greenwald, a half an hour talking about, this is just nuts. It makes no sense. Joe Biden makes no sense. He can't deter anything. He's infirm. On top of it, inflation is piled up. And I need us to get serious about this. We are on the cusp of a big deal war, and you need to know that, even if the economy is burdened by inflation. Stay tuned. I'm Hugh Hewitt, back inside the Beltway. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Dr. Michael Oren, formerly Israel's ambassador to the United States, formerly deputy minister. I call him Israel's Harry Hopkins. Good morning, Dr. Oren. I would like to know, are you on edge about Iran right now? Do you think they're actually going to pull that trigger?
I wouldn't call it on edge. I'd call it vigilant. I'm of the Dirty Harry school, and I know, if you can call me Harry Hopkins, I can make a reference to Dirty Harry.
Yes.
All right. What did Clint Eastwood say? Go ahead. Pull the trigger.
Make my day.
Make our day. Make my day. The Dirty Harry school. And I've long been a member, an adherent of that school. And I think the Iranians are aware of that. Listen, they never retaliated for Qasem Soleimani. They haven't retaliated against Israel proper. What I think we have to be very vigilant about is the possibility of Iranian attacks against Jewish communities and Israeli diplomatic posts around the world. I think there the alert has to be especially high.
Well, I want to add a note to your, they didn't retaliate about Soleimani. My son was at Al-Assad when they fired the ballistic missiles from Iran at Al-Assad, but someone gave us an hour's notice. And so I wonder if they do that kind of thing and your embassy. But Khamenei yesterday at the Eid celebration said it's coming. So do you believe him?
Yeah, the question is, to sound vaguely Clintonian, depends what it is. And it could be a drone strike, perhaps at an Israeli settlement in Judea and Samaria, something up in the Golan Heights. Or, as I said before, it could be attack against the Jewish community abroad. That's what they've done in the past. They've already attacked Israeli tourists abroad. There aren't that many tourists abroad right now because of the situation.
So, Dr. Oren, yesterday, Commentary Magazine taped an hour-long John Podhoretz, Abe Greenwald, Seth Mandel, and Matt Continetti, and they reviewed the incoherence of Team Biden's view on Israel and how they react every day to a different news cycle, and they're not even commenting on the Death to America chance in Dearborn. What is, in your opinion, the Biden policy on the Israel war in Gaza?
To get through it unscathed before November. I think they want to maintain a level of military supplies, a certain amount of diplomatic support, a certain amount, so they can say to pro-Israel voters, Democratic voters, look, we had criticism, but we've maintained these fundamental policies. To their, the progressive voters, people from Dearborn, Michigan, are going to say, look, we didn't put up with this, and we condemned it very harshly. And there are two voices there. If you listen to John Kirby at the NSC, and if you listen to Matt Miller at the State Department, you think you're talking about two different administrations. And sometimes you get very different messages, even from the Secretary of State. They're trying to walk a very, very fine line, and the line is getting thinner.
Dr. Oren, it's not coherent. I mean, I don't really know what they will do when Israel goes into Rafah, which I believe it has to do, or the government will fall. Am I right about that, by the way? If they just say, oh, we're done here and Rafah's fine.
You're half right. We're going to go into Rafah not because the government's going to fall. We're going to go into Rafah because this is what the people of Israel want and demand. And those soldiers, the hundreds of thousands of soldiers who have fought and bled in Gaza for the last 6 months, is what they want. It's what I want. I think it's what my family wants. And, you know, there's this big, I mentioned this before on the program, this misconception in the United States is somehow the prime minister of the state of Israel is also the commander in chief, like the president is. He is not. War making and war decisions are much more consensual here. My hope, my personal hope, is not that I'm not without criticism. I think that we should be flooding the Gaza Strip with humanitarian aid and military support, even building aid stations within Gaza and mobile hospitals in Gaza. We know how to do this. We've been doing it all over the world for rescue relief. I think we should engage with the Biden administration on issues which we formerly weren't willing to engage, what they call a pathway to a Palestinian state. It's just a pathway. It doesn't obligate us in any way. We're on the morning after scenario. We can do that. But we can't say no all the time. And we have to stick our heels in, dig our heels in on those issues on which we cannot concede. And one of them is eliminating Hamas in Gaza. And that we must do.
Your friend, and we'll be a guest soon, Yossi Klein Halevi, said on a podcast recently, this is not Netanyahu's war. This is Israel's war. I don't believe they've internalized that at the White House, or they choose not to project it because of political reasons. Do you agree? We have 1 minute to break, and then we'll come back.
Yes, yes, and no. I think political reasons, yes, because Netanyahu is the gift that keeps giving. You can beat up a Netanyahu. Nothing's not there. You're going to have to beat up an Israel, and that's not a very politically savory prospect. On the other hand, my contacts in the administration have come to believe that they actually do think this is Bibi's war. And therein lies a lot of miscalculations.
Oh, so much miscalculation. Don't go anywhere. Doc Doran will be back after the break. I will play it later in the show. I will put it in the podcast today. I'm going to ask him about Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, because honestly, the more people talk about this in America, the more they reveal that they don't know anything about Israeli politics and they're talking. I don't talk about it because I really don't know much about Israeli politics. Indecipherable to me. I know American politics, but I'm going to talk with Dr. Oren about it after the break. We'll put it on the podcast, play it tomorrow. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Hour number two coming straight up. Noah Rothman of National Review kicks it off. Stay tuned. I'm back now with Ambassador Oren. Dr. Oren, I've listened to enough Israeli media, and I've listened to Haviv and to you and to Yossi and a bunch of other people. I now know about Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and how they are analogous in the United States to the far right wing of the Republican Party or the far left wing of the Democratic Party, but they're in the government. Should they at all figure in our calculation of what Israel's policy is? Because when they beat up on them, they're just picking the marginal figure in American in Israeli politics and making it the face of Israeli politics. It's not how we do it here.
Okay, so again, I feel like I'm repeating myself. The answer to both those questions is yes. What does it mean? You know, yes, they are peripheral figures. They represent important constituencies for this government. And while they do not make the big decisions, and they're saying now they're going to leave the government if the army doesn't go into Rafah, they're going to leave the government if Israel agrees to a certain hostage for ceasefire deal. They're always threatening to leave the government. And one day they actually may make good on it because they're young and they could run again. And some of the popularity of Ben-Gvir has gone up very high during this war, much, much, much less so. But they don't make the big decisions. And that's the fact. They effect a gravitational pull on the government, pulling it rightward. So it'll be difficult. You know, I think that Netanyahu wants to strike a deal with the United States, a grand bargain, in return for maybe not going into Rafah, in return for control over the Philadelphia route. That's the line dividing Gaza from Sinai. That's the route to which all these armaments were smuggled. In return for that, in return for releasing those hostages who are alive, and today Hamas is saying they don't even know who's alive. That's no big surprise. And in return for peace with Saudi Arabia, all right, that will put this all together in one big package. And, you know, Netanyahu and Biden and maybe MBS will get Nobel Prizes. I don't know. But certainly Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are going to oppose this. They're going to oppose it on multiple levels. They're going to oppose it on the failure to enter into Rafah. They're going to oppose it on the release of hostages, the release of prisoners in Israeli jails for these hostages, the ceasefire. They'll oppose it. The question is, will they leave the government? And if they do leave a government, will other parties like Yair Lapid's party, will they come up and take their place? A historical moment of caution is this. Back in 1987 in the Y plantation negotiations with Bill Clinton and Yasser Arafat, right? you know, that was the last agreement signed between Israel and the PLO was Netanyahu and Arafat, believe it or not. The Americans assured Bibi that if he made that concession in Hebron to Arafat, that the Israeli left would step up and back him if the Israeli right bolted. The Israeli right bolted, and the Israeli left didn't support Netanyahu, and he fell. So there's the Y plantation scar, which remains, I think, probably deeply embedded in Bibi's consciousness.
So I want to close with this. I read a story this morning about the impact on Israel of an entire age cohort fighting the longest war in Israel's history. You wrote 2048 before the war began about Israel at 100. It's right. At 75 right now, 76, I guess, soon. How will this change Israel to have this many soldiers and their families, friends, and loved ones watch them? 262 have been killed. 600 total, including the massacre victims on 10-7. How's it going to change Israel, do you think, Dr. Arndt?
Profoundly. It would be a greater impact than the mass immigration from the former Soviet Union in the 1990s. Nearly a million former Soviet Jews came here and transformed Israel. This will be even bigger. This will be the best generation we've known since the 1948 War of Independence. It's a generation that has fought for months in conditions that even I, as an old combat soldier, never experienced, 24-7 combat in the worst possible conditions. They are tough. They're anything but fragile. They're patriotic. They're committed to the country. Oh, my. And in 10, 15 years, they're going to be the prime ministers, if not earlier. And it's a good thing. I'm very optimistic about it. I must tell you.
I must tell everyone to go to get Clarity, Dr. Michael Oren's Substack. And I hope you will start a podcast sometime, Dr. Oren, because there isn't enough really good news. I get the short stuff from the Times of Israel, and David Horowitz hates Netanyahu so much, sometimes it goes off the rails. But does anyone ever say to you, let's sit down and do an hour a day? Because I could use that.
Every day. We have several in the can. They're coming out any day now.
Okay.
It's
okay.
Called Clarity, too. The podcast called Clarity.
Oh, very Thank good. You. Please release them. I will follow it. Thank you, Dr. Michael Oren.
Thank you. Thank you all.
I'm Hugh Hewitt, back inside the Beltway, joined by United States Senator Dan Sullivan from the great state of Alaska. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Great to be back on the program. Thanks for having me.
I listened to your exchange with Secretary Austin yesterday or the day before when you asked him, why are we allowing an Iranian intel ship to provide targeting data for American ships like the Kearney and others and the Eisenhower and to the Houthis and not doing anything about it? I didn't hear his answer. I'm just curious. Do you think we will sink that ship soon? Because we should.
We absolutely should. And, I've been pressing this issue for months now. And to me, it's just a classic example of the weakness of the Biden administration. I know these military officers. And, I said it there, even Secretary Austin, when he was in uniform, he hated the Iranians. And yet we don't bring any pain to the Iranian regime. The Biden administration deterrent appeasement policy with regard to Iran continues. And to me, Hugh, as I mentioned in that hearing, and I pressed him again in the classified setting, I said, this is not rocket science. The Iranian Navy is targeting our Navy. Why don't we put those Iranian spy ships at the bottom of the ocean quickly? And I guarantee you we'll start to reestablish deterrence. I think our military is ready to do it. To be honest, I think our military wants to do it. And I think they're not getting permission to do it. And let me just mention one other thing. I talked to the CNO of the Navy a couple weeks ago, Chief of Naval Operations. I said, Admiral, how worried are you? The USS Kearney took 30 missiles the other day, missiles and drones, 30. They had to shoot them all down. What if one of those slips through? We're going to have sailors and Marines swimming with sharks in the Red Sea, and we're not doing anything to deter this. It's nuts. I think the military wants to do it. They could do it in a minute, heck, in 2 hours, they could sink the whole Iranian Navy. And I don't think they're given the green light by the president, who's weak.
Now, Senator, I've got a son, a son-in-law, and a nephew on active duty in the Navy. To my knowledge, none of them are in harm's way right now. But they have been on the receiving end before of Iranian missiles. One was at Al Asad when they unleash the barrage there. I don't know what parents of people on the Carney think, but are you hearing from them? Because the friends and family and spouses and children of the sailors on the Carney and the INR have got to be wondering exactly what you did. When are we going to stop this?
Well, you're exactly right. It's the Carney. It's the USS Eisenhower. Think about right. that. It's a
5,000 people
aircraft carrier, right?
5,000 people.
There are Marines and sailors on Eisenhower from every state in our great nation. So, look, I'm hearing from the military. And again, you know, the Biden administration's cutting the military every budget, right? This is something else I pressed by Secretary Austin and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs on in the hearing 2 days ago. Every budget, Biden puts forward significant inflation-adjusted cuts. But I'm hearing from the military members that, of course, they understand what deterrence is. And with the Iranians, look, everybody from Thomas Friedman, who's no conservative, have been saying to others, have been saying Iran is paying no price at all in this war in the Middle East. Think about it. You don't have the Houthis without Iran. You don't have Hamas without Iran. You don't have Hezbollah without Iran. And Biden won't touch the Iranians either with kinetic action, military action, or you, just as important, not press the president directly on this, you got to reimpose sanctions on the yes. oil and gas regime. At the end of the Trump administration, because of the massive sanctions we and the Trump administration had put on Iran, they had about $4 billion in reserves left. That's not much, as you know. 3 years later, now with Biden lifting the sanctions, essentially, Iran has about $75 to $80 billion in foreign reserves.
Yeah, and they're selling the oil to China. Senator, I sent your team yesterday via DM over at Twitter X, the commentary podcast in which yeah. John Podhoretz, they're trying to figure out what is the Biden administration policy vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza. And they came to the conclusion all they care about is optics. The optics change every day, so the policy changes every day. Can you do you have any idea what their policy really is about Israel and Gaza?
No, because it changes by the day. And look, I'm not afraid to give Biden credit where credit's due. Initially, after the October 7th attacks, he went to Israel and showed solidarity and was talking very strong about giving Israel the time and space to crush and destroy Hamas. That was the right policy. You know, Hugh, I went over to Israel soon after the October 7th attacks with a bipartisan group of senators. That was when we were supposed to be showing solidarity with our best ally in the Middle East, one of our best allies in the whole world. But as it is with so many other Biden policies, think about energy, for example, what ends up happening is that the far left of the Democratic Party starts to dictate the policy of this White House. And that is clearly what is going on here. The fact that the president now out of the blue says we need a 5 to 7 week ceasefire, where the hell did that come from? I mean, before, look, a ceasefire to me is an opportunity to let Hamas rearm, regroup, reequip, and we got to give Israel the time and space to destroy Hamas. That's what Biden was saying in the aftermath of October 7th. That talking point is now gone. And the reason it's gone is because he's letting the far left of his radical party drive his policy, just like he does on energy.
Senator, I got to ask you about Sinwar, because you're a Marine and you were on the NSC before you joined the Senate. And so Sinwar is watching all this, and I assume that they have some means of getting intel into the tunnels that are left in Rafah. What do you think he thinks is happening? Does he think he's winning?
I think when he hears the President of the United States talking about a months-long ceasefire, he's winning. And here's the other thing you don't read a lot about because the press doesn't want to report on it. The Israelis are doing a very good job in terms of clearing these tunnels. And as you know, Hugh, that is extremely, extremely dangerous military mission, what we call military operations in urban terrain mount. It's the most dangerous military operations you can undertake because you get shot from any angle, a roof, a tunnel, on the street, and they are making significant progress. By the way, they're down in the tunnels, right? That's dangerous stuff. And so, again, when that is happening, I think Sinwar, a couple months ago, probably knew his days were limited. And now I think these guys think they're winning. And if the United States is the one who backs away from Israel, you know, I don't want to say it, but they could be winning. We can't abandon Israel in its time of need. That's the one final thing I'll mention. When I was over there, the one issue that everybody forgets, and when I was over there after October 7th, Israel is in the existential moment of its entire existence. Think about the threats it faces. That country feels like it could be obliterated, and we need to empathize with them first. Of course, you know, I empathize with innocent civilian deaths in Gaza, but it makes it really difficult when Hamas continues to use civilians as shields. They love when the numbers are getting run up on civilian deaths. That's what keeps them in power. But yes, I think Sinwar is probably thinking, geez, I might be able to win this.
And that is a tragedy. Senator Sullivan, keep pushing these witnesses. Excellent job yesterday, the day before, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate your joining me. Keep coming back. Senator Dan Sullivan from Alaska, always good to have him here.
Let me go to an area that you understand very well, both of you, and that's deterrence with regard to Iran. Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, recently observed that fighting through Tehran's proxies, Hamas in Gaza, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Syria, Shia militias in Iraq, Iran is reaping all the benefits in paying virtually no cost of the work of its proxies.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. That's Dan Sullivan coming up next hour. He asked Secretary Austin yesterday, if Iran continues to give targeting information to the Houthis, will we sink the ship that is doing that? Jim Talent joins me, former member of the Senate, former member of the House. Senator, what do you think about the question that your old colleague Dan Sullivan asks Lloyd Austin? Why do we let Iranian ships provide this data without doing anything?
Well, I agree with where Senator Sullivan is obviously coming from, which is it's long past time to impose costs and consequences on Iran directly, which the last time we really, well, other than when Donald Trump took out, or his people took out, Qasem Soleimani, which sent it was a brilliant tactical stroke and sent a message all through the Middle East. But you recall when the man you worked for, Ronald Reagan, Operation Praying Mantis, sank about a third of the Iranian Navy because they were mining and harassing shipping in the Persian Gulf, and then that stopped. So we're long past time when we need to do this, to attack them directly in some way that imposes real costs on them. Sinking ships, sinking platforms, going after the supply.
I think they're actually afraid, Senator. And I'm talking about the triumvirs behind President Biden, Secretary Blinken, Secretary Austin, and National Security Advisor Sullivan. I think they're afraid of what will happen if we sink that Iranian intel ship. What do you think Iran would do if we did that?
I think Iran would probably respond by attacking outside sort of installations, embassies, by trying to stir up some terrorist activities. I don't think Iran is going to try and go to war directly with the United States or Israel. That's not their policy. Their policy is to fight to the last Arab. In other words, to fight through their proxies if they can do it. But in any event, we now have to apply force because we have been appeasing them. You have to understand this occurs against the backdrop of a strategic policy of appeasing Iran, actually trying to build a partnership with Iran, which is what the Biden administration has been engaged in for the last 3 years. And of course, Iran read that as weakness, and that only encourages them to attack.
Do you know what the Biden administration policy is? Can you articulate what it is vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza?
Yeah, it's to get Israel to stop fighting. And they want war off the front pages. And so they want Israel to stop fighting. They have an insoluble political problem, which is part of their base wants Israel, really wants Israel to win, and part of their base really wants Israel to lose. And so they need to get the war off the front pages. I agree with what Senator Cotton says every time you ask him here, that they're responding to domestic political incentives. It's obvious. I mean, to the point where, you know, people like Dr. Oren just say it. I mean, it's, if you don't say it, it'll look ridiculous. So, yeah, it's to get Israel to stop fighting. Now, the problem with that, you, is that, of course, tends to prolong the war because it suggests to Hamas and to Iran that the United States will not support Israel if they escalate or if they continue fighting. And so the policy works against itself in a way. But
let's close on this question, Senator. What do you think Sinwar is thinking right now in his tunnels as he observes what the president says and does and what he doesn't say and what he doesn't do? Sinwar must have access to media. What do you think he thinks he's winning?
Well, I don't know whether he thinks he's winning, but I do believe he thinks that the only way for him to survive personally and for Hamas to survive as an organization is to get Israel to stop fighting. And the only way to do that is their discourse, is their narrative, to get its states to force Israel to back away from what its war aims have been. And so he is going to continue. I mean, he wants civilians to be killed. What happened with the Central Kitchen was a godsend to him. I mean, this is their explicit policy, is to embed with civilians so that there are civilian casualties, so that the West will force Israel to stop short of its war aims. And so that's what he's thinking. He's thinking, if I can hold out a while longer, the Israelis will be forced to stop by the United States. And every time Biden says something that tends to force or to pressure Israel, it encourages him to believe that, and therefore not to give back the hostages and not to seek a solution that would really satisfy Israel.
And if we had only fought the war, he might be on a boat headed to Tehran right now. But we got to fight the war. Hugh Hewitt back inside the Beltway, joined by Noah Rothman of National Review. Good morning, Noah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, Hugh. How are you?
I'm great. I have two big stories today. The first is inflation. The number came out yesterday and people went back on their heels. The Wall Street Journal opining this morning in a news story. The question is now if the Federal Reserve will cut rates, not when. Noah, do you have any idea, because it was published in the Financial Times today, how much inflation has increased since Joe Biden took the oath of office total?
I think it was 14%, almost 15%. Am I right?
It's 18.9%.
Across the board.
Across the board. 18.9%. So my first question to you is, what is the Biden policy on inflation?
To pretend it doesn't exist, or at least to argue it doesn't exist. To try to convince you. I mean, this is something that Democrats have been frustrated over for some time. They've been talking to them, telling themselves, why don't voters look at the statistics, look at the data, see these charts and these graphs and internalize that? They don't, because it's not relevant to their experience. Their experiential outlook is informed by their day to day. And their day to day has been, characterized by rising prices in some very key sectors. A lot of them, the very expensive sectors, things like cars and insurance and certainly houses with regard to high rates and low inventory. So it's not just groceries. And that's the idea that they'll some marginal improvements on the edges of their day-to-day shopping experience will somehow translate to a better outlook on the overall economy just doesn't jibe with how we understand people navigate their lives. If most of the things they buy are more expensive, their overall experience is going to say this is more expensive, even though on the margins over the last couple of months, with this current report being a glaring exception, things have been getting better. Some people are beginning to say in polls, by the way, that they do experience a better outlook, a better consumer outlook, a better outlook towards the economy overall, but it's not informing the broad picture, which is a 60-30 proposition when it comes to the economy.
I think it might be more than 60-30. Now, my second question, which I'm trying to ask all my guests today, what is the Biden policy vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza?
I wish I could say I knew what it was, because I don't think I know what it is. Right now, the president's policy is to seek an end to this war. as soon as possible on whatever terms. Doesn't seem to matter what the terms are, frankly. They just want the fighting to stop. And in doing so, they're leaning on Israel because Israel's the only responsible party to this conflict. The same double standard, by the way, applies to Israel supporters in the United States. The Biden administration has a much higher expectation of their ability to compartmentalize nuance and understand the delicate dance that they're engaged in is for the benefit of everybody else, not them. They expect them to understand, just like Israel. They expect Israel to understand that while it's doing all this stuff behind the scenes, providing them with material support, relative diplomatic cover, even though they've withdrawn it at the United Nations. But when they berate them in public, we expect Jerusalem to understand that's not for their benefit. It's for the region. It's for Western Europe. It's for everyone else. We hold them to a higher standard. I don't know why the president doesn't matter, frankly.
It is an incoherent policy. Now, I listened twice yesterday because I was flying back and I had the commentary podcast from yesterday downloaded before I lost my internet connection from Michigan. And no, you know Abe Greenwald. And Abe said, look, there is no policy. They manage optics every day, whatever the optics are. You know, former President Trump famously said, I watch the shows to Chuck Todd. I'm afraid they're only watching MSNBC at the White House and they respond to whatever they see on MSNBC every day. And therefore, it's a wild roller coaster of responses. And Joe Biden's 8-track tape has faded. You're too young to know what an 8-track tape does. After you play it enough, it doesn't make any music. So Joe Biden's 8-track tape is gone. He doesn't remember what to do about Israel. And therefore, it's wild, Noah. It doesn't make any sense.
First, I want to thank you for assuming that I'm too young to know what an 8-track tape is. That makes me feel better about my age. Yeah, I think it's probably Morning Joe, most likely, who sets the agenda in the White House. And it has everything to do with the relative sense of embarrassment that day over how the administration has been behaving. And I said on the editor's podcast the other day, I think it would do this administration a world of good to identify, for example, one of the more Hamas-friendly members of Congress, like Jamal Bowman, who's on the bubble and who's about to likely be replaced by a Democratic improvement in all accounts in George Latimer. And just throw them under the bus. Say a lot of this stuff that they want is not representative of what the American people want and has nothing to do with my political outlook. The president should be a lot madder at how he's been played over the course of the last several months. Leaning into these negotiations, barely leaning on Hamas to say that, to disrupt these negotiations and give up all these hostages. And then we find out what? They're probably dead. Hamas doesn't have these hostages anymore. They've been playing this game in Cairo and Qatar for several months under the assumption that they had all these hostages as a negotiating chip. They don't have them anymore, including three, four, five Americans. I think it's four Americans who are in Hamas's custody.
Five or six, the number changes.
And the administration doesn't seem to have any emotional bandwidth to devote to the fact that Hamas has killed Americans on October 7th and is killing them now and is playing everybody in the world for a fool. And he's been strung along by it. He deserves to be. He must demonstrate some dissatisfaction with his negotiating partners here. They have made us out to look like idiots.
No, I genuinely believe
American prestige.
Because I've dealt with people who are 80 and older and who are beginning to just become too infirm to do that. I actually believe the president is too infirm to take this all in, and that the triumvir is behind him. Anthony Blinken, Lloyd Austin, and Jake Sullivan are making policy, and they don't know what to do. They are really clueless about what to do. My question to you is, do you think we will back them up if Iran strikes them? Because Iran sounds to me to be very serious about launching a strike from Iran at Israel.
Yeah, that's a big question, isn't it? And it doesn't matter. I don't know what they will do, but it doesn't matter what their thinking is in the White House. They have to. The administration has committed a lot of American naval assets to deterring Hezbollah. That was the goal. It's the explicit stated goal. If deterrence fails, we have to shift to a posture designed to restore deterrence, or else we will get challenges to American naval supremacy and positions, its assets positioned all over the world. Those challenges will proliferate because it will be open season. They'll demonstrate that America's a paper tiger. It doesn't actually mean it when it says it wants to deter bad actors. It'll back down the second, you know, that the costs get a little too high. We can't have that. So Joe Biden wants to, he has no choice but to act.
Senator Sullivan is coming up next hour. Yesterday in a hearing, he said, why haven't we sunk the Iranian ship that is giving targeting data on U.S. war vessels to the Houthis? And I'm going to ask him that again, because the good question is, why not? I want to close by this. Yeah. I missed the story entirely. I was in Michigan. I missed the story entirely that demonstrators in Dearborn chanted death to America. And our mutual friend John Podhoretz is dumbfounded that Joe Biden didn't say, wait a minute. We are a great country. You have your First Amendment rights, but I'm drawing the line here. Are you? He compared it to Trump in Charlottesville. But I missed the story because it wasn't widely covered. Did you see it? Did you know it had happened?
I did see it. It was uncovered by Memory. It's a great institution, a Middle East research institution. And it subsequently caused a bit of a stir in Dearborn. The mayor came out in opposition, obviously, to this conduct, as he should, as everybody should. You don't have to be a political strategist to know that shouting death to America in America will offend a lot of Americans, probably more, and in fact, probably a lot more than it would enliven, jazz, make, you know, enthrall. It's the sort of thing that's really easy to play. This is a softball pitch. Knock it out of the park. Make an example. Have one Sister Soldier moment. Just demonstrate the way you won this presidency, Mr. President, is by telling the progressive movement to go screw. That's how you will occupy the position that you're in. And he subsequently outsourced his entire administration to Elizabeth Warren's campaign staff. And then they look around and wonder why they're in the position they're in. I have an idea. Maybe it's because you completely abandoned the political strategy that worked for you in 2020, have for the last 3.5 years, and are now befuddled by how to navigate the politics that progressives simply don't understand. They look at America like a foreign country. Reconnect to the Scranton roots that you're so proud of, Mr. President. Talk to some of the people in this country who actually like this country and behave as though you're the president of all Americans. That's your job.
Yeah, we're talking to Scranton
right
now.
You're not doing your job.
We're talking to Scranton right now because Vince Benedetto, who I saw up at Hillsdale, the Bull Gold station there, he is not from Scranton anymore. He's a Beltway guy and a Beltway right. millionaire. He got no, and he's old and he's infirm. And Noah Rothman is a great guest, and we'll see you again next week. Noah Rothman, follow him on X. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway, joined by Mary Catherine Hamm, host of Getting Hammered with Vic Mattis. Good morning, Mary Catherine. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you doing, Hugh?
I'm great. I'm looking forward to a warm day in the Beltway. I'm going to listen to Getting Hammered, the Eclipse edition, because I don't really care about the eclipse, but apparently you and Vic did. But Mary Catherine, I flew back from Hillsdale yesterday, and I wasn't listening to Getting Hammered. I listened to a commentary podcast twice, because it was about our incoherent Israel policy. So I have two questions for you, and I'm going to ask every guest today, Josh Kroshauer, Noah Rothman, senators. Everyone gets these two questions. First of all, what is the Biden message on inflation, Mary Catherine?
The Biden message on inflation is things are basically fine. Don't worry about what you're actually seeing with your eyes.
Right,
I mean, they oscillate every now and then between acknowledging that this might be a real thing, but then going straight back to like, don't worry, guys. Have you seen the stock market? The stock market, great, right?
Yeah.
They look to things that don't affect people's daily lives.
Now, I'm going to ask a sub question to question one. You have four children. You have to do the shopping, I assume. Mr. Mary Catherine Hamm does not do the shopping, or you do it together. Are you, like, in shock every time that you go to the market?
Yes. I call this my bacon index. Not that we can afford bacon anymore. But when inflation first started going wild, I noticed that, like, you know, a pack of bacon went from, like, $5 to $8 very quickly. And that's, like, the metric in my head. Other people have different ones for eggs, whatever it might be. But these staples add up. And by the way, Mr. Mary Catherine Hamm is quite a logistician. So he actually keeps us supplied with a lot of what we need around here, because if mom was in charge, we'd run out frequently. But so I just want to tip my cap to him. But yes, I know that if it's hard for us and getting harder, it is so much worse for so many more families. We do have a lot of kids, granted, but we're doing okay. And I know that it can be much more painful for a lot of other people.
You know, I know a lot of families who are doing okay, like you and Mr. Mary Catherine Hamm, like my daughter and her husband and my boys and their wives, and they all go shopping and they all, I never remember complaining about groceries because when inflation was big, when we first got married, there were only two of us, so we didn't eat. But I mean, I just can't imagine my daughter, like you have four children. I just can't imagine the food bill.
Yeah, the volume is high, Hugh. We find cheaper and cheaper ways to buy chicken and ground beef and then just make it into other things.
There you go.
I should do what my ancestors did and just actually cook the whole chicken. Maybe I'll start raising them. Is that the option? I don't know.
I don't know if in Northern Virginia you're allowed. I'll ask the governor. He's coming on later if chickens are allowed. Okay, my second question I'm asking everyone. What? And this, I feel like Final Jeopardy. What is the Biden message on Israel?
Oh, gosh, they have no idea. It seems to be Israel has a right to defend itself until we find it icky. And war is often icky. So please stop and do whatever the terrorists say, which, by the way, will lead to much more icky situations in the future, because Hamas has promised on the border of our ally and free country to do exactly what it did on October 7th over and over and over again. That's their promise. That's why when you cease fire, only one side ceases fire. It is illogical. It is dangerous for Israel not to take Hamas out and prevent it from governing or operating as a military operation in Gaza in the future. It also has another threat in the north. And its biggest ally is like, ew. Your number one priority should be the humanitarian cause of the people who are under Hamas's thumb. Well, a good way to deal with those people being under Hamas's thumb is to get rid of Hamas. And we should support them doing that. It's wild how moral.
The managing editor of Commentary said yesterday, and I think it is brilliant, they don't have a policy on Israel and Gaza. They have a policy about the optics on Israel and Gaza.
Yes.
And as they change, if Chef Andres is mad, they'll meet his objection. If American Jews get mad because something has happened bad, and yet he'll address that. It is incoherent, Mary Catherine. And I listened to this twice because it's 30 minutes of explication of how absolutely incoherent American policy has become. And it just kind of dawned on me. They have no idea what they're doing.
No, I don't think there's a philosophy aside from, yes, that you get a lot of traction. I don't think it's unfair to say when someone famous like Jose Andres is mad about the policy, so they switch sort of wildly at that moment to answer that sort of cultural zeitgeist viral video thing. But it doesn't connect to an overall policy. And frankly, Biden is not capable of being a leader. I do think that in the beginning of this, his gut as a more traditional Democrat said, stand with Israel, right? And it wasn't perfect in the beginning, but it was much better than now. But he's not the leader he needs to be. He could tell his party, he could discipline his left flank. He could speak about how it's morally important to back Israel and insane to leave them hanging when they're facing Hamas. And that could actually change minds. That could actually move a needle if you make that argument to people. Because the opposite side doesn't have a good argument.
I miss Mary Catherine. John talked about it yesterday, that a gathering outside of Detroit chanted death to America. I missed it entirely because I've been in Hillsdale for a couple of days. And John was pointing out when masked people are chanting death to America in America, it is up to the president of the United States to say this is unacceptable. And, you know, that's correct. But I want to know if I'm the only one who missed it, or did you miss it too? Did you see that story?
I did see it, but it took me a while to believe that this was actually just a gathering of potential voters in the United States of America. Like, I looked at the video several times and went a little deeper to verify that's what it was, because it seemed so tragic and terrible and offensive to me that this is what's happening. And again, this is a problem partly with media, where the left never pays the price that the right does for bad rhetoric, right? Like, we've reached a point where people, not just with the rhetoric, which you should denounce as irresponsible, But we've reached a lot of incidents where people have gone beyond free speech. They have harassed people. They have hurt people, particularly on college campuses. They're breaking rules that they should be punished for. And I think Vanderbilt and University of Michigan for actually going ahead and doing that. Pomona College, another place that has done that, punishing folks for going beyond free speech. The left doesn't pay a price for those moments the way that the right does in national politics. Not every single person on the left is asked to denounce these things, to clarify whether they believe death to America is an appropriate chant. And so the president doesn't feel compelled to speak about this. And frankly, the rest of his administration and much of his staff is like, ah, those are kind of our people. I mean, this is their flank. This is a constituency that they are worried about. And they are attempting not to denounce them too much for that reason. I think that's pretty plain.
It is. And what became very obvious, it's the last reference I'll make to yesterday's commentary podcast. Then we'll talk about getting hammered. John pointed out, this is Charlottesville for Biden. All right, this is Trump's Charlottesville for Biden. And Trump botched it. Right. There are good people on both sides. And he didn't mean to say that. He meant to say the bad people are a very small minority of the demonstration. And those small minority should, in fact, be condemned. Biden has not been held to account for the death to America rhetoric of his people. And, you know, it just dawned on me. It took John Podhoretz saying, how is he not out there saying, no, this is America. I'm the president. We are a good country. And you cannot say death to America. I mean, you can, but we're going to condemn you. I think that was quite the objectively poignant observation, Mary Catherine.
No, the two are analogous. It is correct to say, and I've heard other people say, there's a Charlottesville every other day in this country right now. It's just from the left. It's coming from the left. So it's not nationalized in the same way. It's not applied to every left-leaning politician. And yeah, he should come out and say, hey, death to America is a bad chant. Y'all should not be engaging in this. We should maybe not be engaging with people who do this in the streets. But there is no pressure for him to do that. And the press will not apply it.
I want to suggest there's a Wall Street Journal poll this morning that shows 20% of black men are going to vote for Donald Trump and 11% of black women, which is almost double the number of black women. Is this why? Does this explain everything? They're just in total panic mode. They're going down. They know they're going to lose to Trump. The president is infirm. Inflation, this was a stunner in the Financial Times today. Do you know, Mary Catherine, how much inflation has gone up total since he was elected president, since he took office?
I do not know the number. I know at one point it was 9%.
18.9% cumulative inflation rise since he took office. Well, and so it'll be 20% by the time he's up for re-election in November and October. How does anyone win that?
Now, look, okay, so we have the counterexample, right, not to rain on the parade, which is 2022, when all the polling said that Democrats and Republicans alike were aligning with Republicans' message on the economy, that they were speaking to the issues that people cared about, and yet you didn't see the red wave in 2022 that maybe you expected to see, right? So that's the other side of the evidence. However, this precipitous drop-off, particularly among non-white voters, which is such a key part of their coalition, particularly non-white male and working-class voters, by the way, is such a problem for them that I do think that's one of the reasons they're trying to contain this constituency that's, you know, out in Dearborn or out in the streets doing these things, is because they're trying to counterbalance this loss of non-white voters in other areas, because it is such a crucial part of the coalition. And frankly, Republicans don't have to get that at full percentage to vote for them. But if you peel off some from Democrats because they're so reliant on that block, if some of them decide to stay home, which I'm sure many will, because the choices for them do not look thrilling. And certainly Biden has not improved their lives on a daily basis. That spells real problems for Democrats up and down the ballot.
Amen. I will be listening to Getting Hammered today as I trundle about the Beltway. I would recommend everyone follow Getting Hammered, listen to Getting Hammered, and by all means, come back and see Mary Catherine next week. Thank you, Mary Catherine Hamm. MK Hammer on X. I'm Hugh Hewitt, Josh Kroshauer, the editor of Jewish Insider. Josh, good morning. Welcome back. I've asked everyone this question today. What is President Biden's policy vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza? Can you articulate it?
Not clearly. I mean, the policy has been very reactionary. It's been, it's changed in the last week or week and a half, especially ever since the accidental Israeli strike against the World Central Kitchen convoy. And it doesn't really articulate. I mean, I think this is the biggest problem. And we saw this in the Rose Garden yesterday. There hasn't been a clear articulation of how we're dealing with Iran, which is, after all, Hugh, as you know, the straw that stirs the terrorism drink in the region. And there's a lot of fear right now in Israel about a retaliatory strike, perhaps on Israeli soil, from Iran in response to the attack in Damascus against the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard forces.
So, I keep refreshing Times of Israel, but I haven't seen any attack yet this morning, but I keep refreshing it. Josh, I want to make sure I ask you this, because Stephanie, my friend, asked me to continually focus. Anti-Semitism, acts of anti-Semitism, spitting on Jews going into shul, things like that, attacks on Jewish delis, is off the charts. Do you think the Biden administration has talked enough about this?
We just did a story. We actually did deep reporting, and we found that President Biden publicly has not said anything about anti-Semitism, has not condemned anti-Semitism publicly since February. And he said all the right things in the couple weeks after October 7th, a month or two later. But as the left has sort of dominated the party's politics and has disrupted a spate of anti-Semitic incidents all across the country in cities, on college campuses, you've seen the public displays of condemnation from Biden himself, at least. We didn't see it in the State of the Union, Hugh. We haven't seen the kind of rhetoric you would expect, I think, from the commander in chief at a time of really great concern in the Jewish community. So, you're seeing more pressure that this White House is putting on Israel when it's under siege. You're seeing less talk about anti-Semitism. Publicly, at least, from the administration. And it makes you wonder whether this is a response to sort of the growing power of the left in Democratic Party politics.
I think it is. I think it's pretty hard to come to any other conclusion. But I think the president is infirm, but the triumvirs, Lloyd Austin, Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, do you think they understand what's happening to Jewish Americans right now?
I think they do. And we know, and we also reported that there are a lot of private conversations, a lot of, they've been involved in creating a strategy privately behind the scenes that a lot of Democrats and Republicans in Congress are also championing. So, privately, they're aware, they're certainly aware of what's going on. But the bully pulpit matters, Hugh. This is a really volatile time in our country on the national security front, but also politically, where you have extremes trying to assert themselves within, I would say, both parties. But certainly right now in the Democratic Party, you have functionally anti-Israel, even at times, on the extremes, the pro-Hamas contingent on the far left. And instead of having a moment where you had in Dearborn, I know you've probably talked about this on the show, Hugh, where you had a community leader in Dearborn, Michigan, an area that the White House has been very attuned to politically, who said death to America and got cheers at a big rally over the last weekend. Where is the condemnation from the White House? That's the kind of leadership. That's where the bully pulpit matters in politics and in governance. And we just haven't seen that recently from this White House.
You know, Josh, I actually missed that story because I drove to Ohio on Friday, came back on Sunday, went to Michigan on Monday, came back yesterday. So I've been traveling. I missed that story. But then I listened to the commentary pod and they talked about, I'm stunned that death to America has not been condemned by the White House. Do you think they'll do it today? I mean, KJP did, but the president didn't.
KJP, yeah. Yeah, very, very, very short. I mean, she was very, very in the briefing room. The Fox News reporter asked and she condemned it briefly, but we haven't heard anything from the president. And look, this is we're seeing the growth of extremes within, I would say, both party coalitions. But you hear all about it when it comes to Republicans and Ukraine. And we've heard that loud and clear. We're not hearing it when it comes to essentially what amounts to sort of a pro-Hamas constituency on the far left that isn't being called out enough from Democrats and additionally from the administration, even though you did see a brief when she asked whether she would condemn the speaker's remarks. She said, yeah, I believe. Yes. KJP said yes in the brief.
Quick exit, Josh. Yesterday on the commentary pod, which I recommend to everyone, John Podhort said this is Joe Biden's Charlottesville moment, that his left is to him as the Charlottesville demonstrators were to Trump. Do you think it's being covered that way by the mainstream media?
Well, it's not being covered that way, certainly. But I do think there's a parallel to be drawn between. So I feel like I'm kind of having a Groundhog Day moment where, you know, the creeping antagonism towards Ukraine on the right is sort of being mimicked right now on the left between this odd antagonism towards Israel and an indulgence of some of these radical sentiments on the far left and that have been explicit. I mean, UC Berkeley, there was a really ugly moment where a professor was harassed.
Dean Chemerinsky, our friend, And Josh, we are out of time. Thank you, Jewish Insider. Follow Josh on X at Josh Krosshour. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Good morning, America. Hugh Hewitt back inside the Beltway. As you know, I am a Virginian. I'm pleased to welcome back the governor of the Commonwealth, Glenn Youngkin. Governor Youngkin, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Good to have you again.
Hey, good morning, Hugh. Thanks for having me. And I'll tell you, we've been hard work in Virginia. We just released a Common Ground budget, which I think we can deliver a priority spending package for Virginians without raising taxes, which is, of course, what the General Assembly wants to do. And I want to keep taxes down. I think we can land this.
Now, I want to talk through this because the Financial Times this morning reported that since President Biden took office a year before you did, the national inflation rate cumulative is up 18.9%. Against that backdrop, a Democratic Assembly proposed to you, what, $2.3 billion in tax hikes?
2.6.
What are they thinking?
Yeah, I mean, you can't help but hear the loud cry from Virginians who are living paycheck to paycheck as the Biden economy steals more and more and more of their hard-earned money. I mean, yes, the average is 18.9, but Hugh, you look what's happened to grocery prices, which are up 25%. I was just with a diner owner a couple weeks ago, and he was telling me his egg prices have tripled in the last 3 years. It's at the gas pump where we're seeing all of a sudden the race back to $4 in the summertime and the failed Biden energy policies really once again biting Americans and Virginians. And then just think about it. If you have 7.5% to 7.75% mortgage rates, the American dream of owning a home is nearly impossible. And that is compounded by the fact that rental prices go up as a byproduct of high mortgage rates. I mean, the net is that the everyday lives of Virginians and Americans are being so pinched and squeezed by the Biden inflationary economy, and they feel it every day. And so I have this General Assembly who came and said, we want to raise taxes in the middle of this. I put forth a budget to lower taxes in this to get more money in people's pockets. We've done it for the last 2 years with $5 billion of tax relief. But my battle now is just to make sure that there are no tax increases. And I think we can land this because the Virginia economy is doing great. We have 200,000 more people working than 2 years ago. We can afford to fund our priorities, and we certainly aren't going to raise taxes.
I talked to Mary Catherine Hamm earlier, like me, a Virginian governor, but she has four small kids. And so relief at the margins matters. And let's take, for example, toll relief in Hampton Roads. I go down there all the time, got family in the Norfolk, Virginia Beach area, and it's expensive. And if people are pinched, they can't pay those tolls. So what did you do there?
Well, of course, we have a big commuter system between Norfolk and Portsmouth down in that area. And so we put forth a program in partnership, of course, with leadership from down there to provide 14 free trips a week for folks coming back and forth to work if you earn less than $50,000. Really important. So, of course, if you can afford to pay the toll, that's a whole different story. But for folks earning less than $50,000, this is a real, real burden. And so they can get back and forth to their job 14 times a week and not pay a toll.
Now, Governor, I want to know how you're going to land this, because this legislature is irresponsible. They killed the move of the Wizards and the Caps because they just don't like you. And that was so, that's shooting yourself in the foot. How in the world are you going to land a budget when you have really hard left Democrats in charge of key committees?
Well, first of all, I, of course, am very disappointed. I think Virginia really is going to miss out on a great economic development opportunity with the stadium.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, Hugh, the reality is no one got anywhere by looking in the rearview mirror. And so I'm driving forward to get this budget landed. It's the most important thing on our plate. And as I said, I have put forth, I think, a common ground budget that does not raise taxes, that in fact is funded because jobs have grown, not that taxes have grown. And I think we can land a common sense, common ground budget. I'm speaking to lots of people, and I think Virginians deserve this. Virginians want this. This is why they elected us.
Now I want to talk about the 777 bills that you signed. You amended 116. That's in the Virginia Constitution. You vetoed 153. Now, Governor, you ran a lot of private sector businesses. That's just too many laws, isn't it? That's 1,000 bills you have to assess.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary number of bills that came our way. And, of course, the difference is over the last 2 years, we had divided legislature. We had a two-seat majority in the House. Of course, we have a one-seat minority now. And what that meant was over the last two legislative periods, we had, you know, 800 to 850 bills that came. And now we've got 1,046 that came our way. And so I've had to really dig into all of that legislation. And we've got a lot of places to work together. Listen, we made great progress on combating human trafficking. We made great progress on opening up job training and apprenticeships. We made great progress on combating fentanyl. And I am so proud of the bipartisan bill that can now penalize those folks that are housing pill presses and distributing counterfeit drugs. But the reality is there were a lot of bills that would not have made it through the last 2 years with a House that would have taken them off the table. And so that's been my job this time.
Let me take a quick aside. The First Lady of Virginia, your wife, Ms. Youngkin, pioneered the one pill can kill. I use that everywhere. I think it's the most effective bit of messaging I've seen in the last few years. Does the budget embrace it, or do Democrats begrudgingly acknowledge that it's effective and therefore they don't want to use it?
Yeah, our proposed common ground budget embraces it. The reality is, on average, 5 Virginians are dying a day from fentanyl poisoning and overdose.
Wow.
And we have just taken this in a strong way in education. We're interdicting the drug flow through our highways with a tremendous effort in state police, local police, and federal law enforcement this month. And it's been amazing the impact that we've had in seizing illegal drugs. And then finally, we're doing everything we can to make sure that folks know what to do if somebody has an overdose. And of course, that's a naloxone antidote. And so this is not a partisan issue. It's one we've struggled to get the penalties in place for the distributors. And I ran back in 2021 and again have carried the message that we need to penalize anyone who distributes a drug that kills somebody with a felony homicide. And that is a place that the General Assembly has not come with me. I'm going to continue to battle for that because we must make sure that folks that deal these illegal poisons are penalized.
So, Governor, a lot of people don't know. Virginia has a one-term limit on a governor. So you're in your closing sprint now. You've got 18 months left. What is your – you've got a AAA bond rating. The economy's in good shape. It's booming. What is the Youngkin sprint to? What do you want to get done the most in the next 18 months?
I first want to make sure we land a budget right now that's common sense, that doesn't burden Virginians with more taxes. That's my top priority right now, Hugh. But over the course of the next now roughly 20 months, we are going to continue to drive to get Virginians great job opportunities, to make sure we train the workforce, and that we continue to build an educational system that enables parents and students to seek the best opportunities for them, their choices, their opportunities. And we have to open up our educational system to make sure that happens. And then finally, when we do this and we can drive safe communities and on top of that, stand up for Virginians that need help with this behavioral health crisis, we will have the most impactful Virginia for the future generation of Virginians. Hugh, what's really exciting is people are recognizing, and as a Virginian, you know this, it's the best place to live and work and raise a family, not because I say so, but because job opportunities, great schools, and safe communities are demonstrating it every day.
Now, Governor, I want to look forward a little bit. You watch as our neighbor to the north had their bridge collapse because of an air. We have got shipping like that in Hampton Roads. Are you feeling pretty good about the infrastructure of Virginia and its safety and how it's being maintained?
Hugh, I am. I was just down with the Virginia Port Authority last Friday, and we took a deep review of not only all of the bridges and tunnels, but also the way that our port is supporting the flow of cargo that we're taking off of Baltimore right now while they're repairing their channel and their bridge. And I think one of the key facts is that we have tunnels. And so the shipping lanes between the Port of Virginia and Hampton Roads and open sea lanes is tunnels, not bridges. Yes, we have 13 bridges that run over some of our rivers. They're inspected all the time. They're actually constructed in ways that provide good protection. But most importantly, it is this series of open shipping lanes and tunnels that provides us great comfort. With that said, there's a lot of project work going on in order to continue to invest in our bridge system to make sure they're safe and rapid response if there was a problem. And Hugh, one last thing, I'll just remind everybody, we have the largest naval base in the world that occupies Hampton Roads. And so the security and safety of that entire shipping lane is constantly on the forefront of everyone's minds. And therefore, while I continue to feel confident in the infrastructure that we have, we're going to continue to invest and monitor it closely.
Now, I'm going to close by talking about road repair because you're a governor. I drove the Pennsylvania Turnpike back and forth in the last 5 days, and I want to call up Governor Shapiro and say, can you please get it done? Because it's impossible. The 81, I don't get on the 81 very often. I'm on the 64 a lot and the 95 always. Do you think you'll bring that in? Will you land that set of improvements on the 81? Because there are a lot of commuters listening right now who dread being on the 81.
Yeah, so 81 is a top priority. There's $3 billion of improvement projects that will move between now and 2032. I added another $70 million specific project that needs to get accelerated. And we created space for another $175 million of excess cash flow out of the budget the next 2 years, again, to accelerate projects. So there is an enormous amount of funding and project activity that will happen on I-81. I know I'm going to get calls, Hugh, over the course of the next 2 years that say there's so much construction on I-81, but this is what we have to do because this is such an important thoroughfare. It's one of the reasons why Virginia's logistics system is expanding and growing so fast is because our connectivity. We have the most efficient operating port on the East Coast. We're just finishing a giant dredging and widening project. We couple that with huge investment in our rail and highway system, including I-81, and Virginia's going to continue to have the best arteries and connectivity in the country.
Good luck on landing the Common Ground budget. Governor Glenn Youngkin, thanks for coming back. I look forward to talking to you repeatedly in the next 20 months.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.